Greetings all, what is the good word? Thank you for stopping the scroll and spending some of your valuable time with us. This is the Coptimizer podcast, and I'm your host, Patrick Flannelly, retired chief of police and all-around wannabe renaissance man. Here we look to spend some time with leaders and pioneers that have a passion for public safety and those who look to build strong and resilient individuals and organizational cultures, both of which result in stronger communities. We look across industries with a focus on peak performance. Our biggest questions, what can I do to squeeze every little drop of life out of each day? How do I get a little bit better today than I was yesterday? And how can I tap into the energy that makes it all possible? While our focus is on first responders and those in public service, the lessons shared here on the Coptimizer podcast are universal. Our goal is to hire healthy, retire healthy, and maximize impact in our personal and professional lives in that time in between. To drive value and squeeze every drop out of our performance so we can be awesome for our families, our departments, and our communities. Better performing officers make for better performing organizations. This is not a complicated truth. It is the simple truth. From the top cop to the street cop and all those working in support of high-performing organizations, this show is for you. It's time to Coptimize. Welcome back to the Coptimizer podcast. I'm excited today to have author, army officer, I think probably just person extraordinaire, Michael Irwin on the podcast today. And we're going to talk about leadership, but more specifically, well, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but more specifically, why leading yourself first is so important. And for those that are watching on the YouTube channel, I'm gonna throw his book up here. And I didn't show him this before we went on the air, but I have
a lot of marks.
Yeah, when I read books, I use these little post-it pens. They have the pen on one end, they have the highlighter, and then they have the highlighter tabs that go in there. And I burn through these things like crazy. So all the books that I have, they're all massacred, and I write notes in them. And I'm going to try to get to as many of these notes as I can as we get going. But, before I do that, I'm going to let Michael introduce himself. He is currently the founder and CEO of the Character and Leadership Center. And maybe he'll tell us at some point a little bit about that. And yeah, Michael, thank you. Welcome for being here.
Hey, absolutely. Yeah. Great, Pat. Appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, I mean, just in a nutshell, I born and raised in Syracuse, New York. And as you and I've already discussed on this, parents were both police officers. My mom was actually the first woman on the Syracuse Police Department back in 1974. And my grandfather was a lieutenant on the SPD and my father was a sergeant. He actually never took the test, never wanted to become an officer, always wanted to stay in the trenches, and he was the director of the child abuse department. So he had a lot of tough work that he did early on, and in my childhood, and so I remember seeing some of that like play out, like even in my own life, and I would see how he would interact with families and all that. But so that's where I'm from, and I went to West Point, and I started there in 1998, which means that I was my senior year when September 11th, 2001 happened. So that drastically changed everything for me, and I ended up going to, serve 13 years on active duty all across the country, Arizona, North Carolina, Texas, then one deployment to Iraq, two to Afghanistan. And that brought me to grad school at the University of Michigan, where I started to work on this book that we're talking about, Lead Yourself First.
Well, thank you very much for your service. I guess we're just going to have to start there because we've had this conversation a few times about where were you on 9/11. It was such a pivotal time for a lot of us. Having been a veteran myself, long removed from there, but I was on the police department for 6 years at that point.
and I was a field training officer, and I had a conversation about how that for the period of months after 9/11, I just didn't think that I was very effective as a training mm-hmm. officer, because I was just very distracted. And one of those lessons that you learn, right, is I was allowing myself to be distracted by things that I had no control over, and there was nothing I could do about it. I think probably a lot of us felt that way. There was something, you just wanted to be able to do something. You wanted to be able to make a difference, but
totally.
Yeah. But you can't. So
yeah, it was very frustrating. Yeah. I mean, the brief story of that is I was actually in New York City on September 10th, 2001. I was there trying to watch the Yankees baseball game, and got rained out. And I remember driving across the George Washington Bridge, looking to my left, the south, as I was driving back to West Point, thinking just, you know, this beautiful city, and seeing the Twin Towers and all that. And yeah, I was in, I went to class during first hour. I went to breakfast formation in the morning, came back because I was up late. So I took a nap during my first hour. My brother called me, right? Because my brother was a plebe at West Point, and I was, you know, a firstie at the time. And so look what's happening. And so it's crazy that it was, you know, 45 miles down the Hudson River away. So not only, you know, like it certainly affected the entire nation, but especially for those of us nearby, it hit extra hard.
Yeah, native New Yorkers. That's, such a tragedy. But that, you know, I don't want to spend, we could talk for days just about that alone, but that right there changed the trajectory for what your future was going to look like, because at the time, if you're, you know, not in a wartime, it's kind of like, well, what am I going to do in my job? What, you know, how am I going to use this? Where am I going to go next? But yeah, it gets pretty real in that moment where you know that, well, we're going to war.
And totally. It was,
So I think it's fascinating. You come from a family with two, both parents are police officers, and you wind up at a military academy, and at least one brother. So, both wind up at a military. That's amazing, because that it's quite an accomplishment just to get into any of the service academies. Very competitive, academically and otherwise. So were you playing any sports or was it?
Yeah, I played baseball and my brother played golf. And then ironically, like both of my sisters married West Point graduates. So for my kids, they've got and there's 18 of them. I got five. My sister Bridget's got five. Monica and Mark each have four. And so their father and then three uncles are West Point grads. So the running joke is, you know, no pressure or anything. So, I never went, you know, neither of my parents went to college. You know, they joined, this is a different time, right? You could, they joined the police departments without a college degree. And, you know, they said, hey, we want our kids to be able to go to college one day. They made that a priority early on. I remember hearing them talk about that when I was young, and all four of us went on and, you know, went on to college, and, you know, two of us on to the U.S. Military Academy. But that alone forever changed our life, because that is such a formative four-year experience that almost could not be more different than your traditional college experience, right? Like, no freedom. You're told what to wear, where to be. You get in trouble if you're not there. The idea of, like, ditching class is not even, like, it doesn't make any sense to do it, because, like, you get in way more trouble for ditching one class than you do, you know, if you just, like, take it on the chin and just go, you know, go to class, you know, even if you don't want to or you have something else to do. So, yeah, it was a highly formative experience in terms of how intense it was. 47 months, about 5.5 hours of sleep a night. You know, so all of that came together to really shape and mold me into the leader and the person that I grew into and have become today.
That experience, I think, is something that I want to kind of touch on as we go through this podcast. But as growing up as the child of a police officer, I, you know, being a dad, I have three boys. One actually just got out of the service, and one's in college and one's in high school still. I really, I don't know that I spent enough time contemplating what life is like for the child of a police officer. There were times here and there, like, you know, the kids sometimes, like, they don't get invited to parties, or, you know, so, you know, me, I'm like, well, that's not necessarily a bad thing,
right?
Because yeah, they have a built-in excuse, like, no, I can't. Well, at least you'd say parties where maybe some activity is going to go on that shouldn't go on.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, I didn't necessarily appreciate the, you know, the kind of the pressures that can put on a child when they're just concerned about your safety and your well-being.
Totally.
Most, you know, when they were old, most of the time that, you know, as they were growing older, I was the chief. I was chief for the last 10 years of my career. So they weren't necessarily around for the first 14 years when I was working the midnight shift, because I wanted to, and I was working SWAT and narcotics and doing those things that were all the fun stuff. But yeah, your dad working, you know, sex crimes, and particularly, you know, the child sex crimes, that, wow, that, you know, that is such difficult work. And, you know, if you want to talk about God's work, that is it, because we don't
very
have
hard
enough people doing it.
Yeah. Very, you know, very hard. And, you know, it's, you know, bigger picture, like you said, about being the, you know, the child, you know, of a police officer. I mean, there's just some of the small stuff, like, you know, our name wasn't in the phone book back in the day when you had phone books, you know, that people used. Like, our name and our phone number wasn't in there. You know, and I'm like, why can't I find our name in here? Well, I don't want someone who I've arrested to be able to look up and figure out where we live, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, and of course, like, my dad, like, knew what marijuana smelled like and all these kinds of things. So, like, it was always a running joke of, like, yeah, if you come home smelling like that, first of all, I will know it, right? Second of all, you will be in huge trouble. So I never, still to this day, 43 years old, right? I've never smoked a cigarette, never smoked marijuana, never tried it, never dabbled it. It was part of my identity of, like, nope, you know, my dad was a cop and that was not going to fly in the Irwin household. So,
well, see, there are, it's not
a lot of benefits,
not negatives. There's a lot of benefits
that
come with it as well. So maybe real quickly, can you tell us, the Character and Leadership Center, what is it that you're doing there? And I think, and I ask you that because I want to go back into your book, and I'll tell a little story about why your book resonated with me so much, but maybe just that to kind of give a little background for the listener about what you're doing.
So when I transitioned from active duty to the reserves, in the Army in 2015, you know, I knew that I wanted to, you know, take my continued passion for and focus on leadership and continue to bring it forward. And but I didn't want to be like Mike Irwin LLC and come up with, you know, like, because a lot of times people often make it very, like, centric around them. I wanted to make it very much about the ideas. And at the core of positive psychology is this focus on character. And I studied leadership. And so that was where the name came from, Character and Leadership Center. And so my first book came out in 2017, co-authored with Ray Kethledge. And then my second book came out 2021, late in the year, with Willis Duvall. So I'm a big team player in life. I'm co-author on both of my books. We leverage strengths from one another, and we put together, I think, you know, two pretty powerful perspectives on leadership. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, well, what messages are the most important for leaders in the information age to hear? And because people often ask that question, they say, well, what is the common ground between leading yourself first in solitude and leadership as a relationship? And it's really that if you're going to show up for other people and you're going to lead and you're going to connect with and build relationships, well, you have to start with yourself. And so that's the bridge between the book that has two titles that seem different, but they're not at all. Right. And so a lot of what I focused on that work has been working with people across sports, military, business, nonprofits, government, really every sector out there that is interested in that message, what I call that 1-2 punch of leading yourself first and then building relationships and forging relationships. That's how I view leadership. That's how I view the, if you can, and again, I don't want to oversimplify it, but to distill it down, I believe you got to lead yourself first, and then you have to connect with and build relationships with other people. And so really that's the work that I do through the Character and Leadership Center, you know, working with lots of different, again, programs and organizations across different sectors, which really is encouraging because it shows that this is not just a message that resonates in one sector, but really it's something that is broadly applicable. And you start talking about law enforcement and first responders and these ideas, like, it just, it resonates with people across so many different interests and professions.
Well, you know, we've kind of taken it on the chin the last few years in our profession. Yep. Some of it rightfully so. You know, some of it, a lot of it, you know, I think is more of a misunderstanding and a lack of clarity from the general public about what our roles and responsibilities are. But that being said, you work with all these different groups. And one of the things inside of law enforcement that I have seen is there is a sense or a feeling oftentimes by leaders that nobody understands the pressures that we're under, mm-hmm. that the pressures are unique to us and not anybody else. And while that might be true in some cases, I really don't believe that. I think everybody is facing the same challenges. It's probably just a matter of scale and what they're doing. So is that something that you see and what you see? Yeah. So you have this opportunity to work with these different groups. So
absolutely. Well, and so one of my mentors, Jim Collins, he often talked about this, that great schools have more in common with great police organizations, with great businesses, with great military units, right? There's a lot of common ground there. So again, they've got more in common with those than they do with average schools or average units or average, you know, businesses, right? So it's really a thread of greatness, and people who are dedicated to greatness, there's a lot more in common there despite the differences in sector than people might think. So I absolutely agree. This is the kind of thing too, like veterans will often do this and say, oh, well, you can't possibly understand what it's like to go to war or be shot at. And it's like, no, first of all, there's definitely people out there who can't, right? First of all, there is some people right. who can and have been shot at in America, right? Or have been, by the way, if they have been shot at, they've been in a car accident, they've come upon a car accident, they've experienced something really traumatic. And in their jobs, they do. Think about first responders. Think about so many different professions out there that deal with people in the emergency room, right? So mental health clinicians, people who deal with people who are suicidal. So there's a lot of people out there, despite different professions, that absolutely can relate to the acute level of stress and to the threat and the of potential violence, that folks within various professions feel, to include law enforcement.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I spent 27 years, and thankfully I never had to shoot anybody. I came very close on several occasions where I could have, didn't, and it worked out. I've definitely heard the sound of gunfire, never been shot. But my next door neighbor, who by the way is a Michigan grad.
Yep.
And his daughter's there now. he's a university professor here at Purdue University. And he, while traveling in New Orleans with a group of friends, gets, they walk in in the middle of a robbery in a hotel, and he winds up getting shot in the leg and survives.
Yeah.
But I would have never known that had he, one night he just, yeah, just kind of, matter of fact, they kind of told me about it. I was like, wait a minute, how do I not know this? But
So it's not making assumptions, right? That very often people can understand, and like obviously, like the amount of stress, right, that so many police officers go through, it is hard for lots of people on the day-to-day to be able to understand what that feels like. But again, I just think that it still isn't very helpful to helping us be our best version of ourselves, to reaching our full potential. To say, no, you can't understand me. I just think that it's better suited when we can find common ground and we can say, hey, even if you don't know what it's like to walk a mile in my shoes, right? Be that, whatever the factor might be. It's still helpful to acknowledge that other people can relate, through empathy and through some focus and care, they can at least somewhat understand what you go through or what you've been through,
And it's important for police officers, especially police leaders, to really recognize that, and also to understand that it's probably a good practice to have a good, diverse group of friends and family networks, so you're not always hanging out with other police officers. Yes,
that's right.
So I also have to touch on this too, since you mentioned Jim Collins, and he is the wrote the forward for Lead Yourself First. But I have to give a huge shout out to him because he was very influential in my life. I'm a avid reader, and I used to have a Barnes and Noble close to where I lived, and it had the first Starbucks coffee shop in there. And I've told a couple of book stories about going in there. One about how I found the Zone Diet, but that's also where I found, working the midnight shifts, getting up, going, grabbing a cup of coffee and perusing books. But that's also where I found Good to Great. And this was before I was a supervisor. I read this book and it was just so impactful because I was thinking about all these things that in the business world about the way businesses operate, you know, what separates a good business from a great business.
Right.
And I was like, wow, you know what? In terms of thinking about police departments and police operations, it's not even a question I'd even pondered before. Like, well, what is even a good police officer? How do we define that? How do we understand and I'm sure your dad would say Syracuse PD is the best PD in the country, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and we all say that, right? Like our agency is the best. Prove me wrong. So,
totally.
And that's just where the pride comes from. But you talk about when you were working in an intel group, you were doing very important work in Afghanistan, and you're reaching the pinnacle of this work. And then all of a sudden the Army says, hey, time to go. We need to send you on professional development. So the Army says, hey, it's time to go. We're going to send you to Michigan. You're going to go start to work on your master's and your PhD.
Yep.
But you didn't want to go.
Yeah. So totally. I mean, well, what would happen is that we had just surged into Afghanistan. So after all the focus had been on Iraq for the past 4 or 5 years, there was a realization of, hey, we really got to figure out what's going on in Afghanistan and get it under control, because the insurgency, the Taliban-led insurgency, was gaining strength. And so I had amassed a ton of knowledge and experience in 06, 07, 08, 09 there. And so it felt like, geez, I should somehow be adding some value to this with all that I've learned in the past 3.5 years. So yeah, so when I've been selected for grad school, though, like a year and a half earlier. And so I probably wouldn't have applied if I had known we were going to be surging into Afghanistan and it was going to become America's like strategic priority, in 2009, coming out of the presidential election. And so, I did all that I could to stay engaged to support those that were deploying or getting ready to deploy. But there's a real limit you could do because, you don't have access to your classified systems and things like that. But yeah, I spent a lot of time trying to help those out because while the Army said, nope, you're moving on to grad school, we were selected, go for it. It was definitely, challenging for me to leave behind this field that I knew so well.
And I think that there's very similar things happen in policing is that, I've mentioned this to you before we went on air, but I was very fortunate to have great mentors and great leaders. Any success that I've had over my career is, in a large part due to them developing me and exposing me to the things that were going to help me grow, to help me understand, the complexities of what we were dealing with. But my predecessor as chief was also an Army officer. And he deployed a couple times. He was in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But he was a strong believer in this concept of professional development, leadership training, making sure people were getting exposed, sending them to the schools that we needed them to, doing the self-development on their own. Although I will take credit for making him read Jim Collins's book, Good to Great. But so you experienced that now. And I think, the
big time,
the desperation, I guess, maybe in a sense, maybe it's too strong a word, but it's like, oh my gosh, there's people in harm's way that I feel like I could help. And here I'm stuck in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Totally. It was a sense of absolute, guilt probably is the right word I would use. And we talk about this in Lead Yourself First, that other people can tell you, and they did, hey, Mike, you've done your part. You did your 3 rotations. You're doing everything. Like, you're time to move on, time to move on to the next thing. And at the end of the day, a lot of people can tell you that, but only one person can change their mind. it's you, right? You have to change your mind if you're going to, you know, if you're going to change it on this. And so that's just so important to realize that ultimately everyone can be telling you one thing over and over and over again, but you have to be convinced that they're right, or you have to make up your decision. And I did. Eventually I got to the point of like, okay, on those runs in solitude, I would go on, I would talk to myself and say, hey, like, what can I do now? How can I make sure that I'm, you know, supporting the veteran community, the military community to the best of my ability? And that's when I founded Team Red, White, and Blue. And that's when I came up with the vision initially that was very small, but it grew through leading myself first through solitude to be able to enrich the lives of many of those veterans who, you know, had either just served in Iraq or Afghanistan or would become veterans in the years ahead. And so that's absolutely a big part, you know, of the power of solitude, of leading yourself first, is that it gives you the ability to see things through a fresh perspective. And sometimes it's hard earned, hard fought perspective, but it's essential to be able to establish that.
Well, and that was like a little sneaky, humble little mention there. I'm going to brag about that a little bit for you, because we didn't talk about that in the beginning, but you are also the founder of Team Red, White, and Blue,
yep,
which is a nationwide organization. Over, I don't know what the count is now. I think I read last time was over 200,000 members.
Yep.
And you know, using and I've been into CrossFit competitions. I've run Spartan races. I've run local races. There's one here that a friend of mine puts on every year to support our local veterans home, Indiana Veterans Home, where he does Ruck and Run. And I always see those shirts everywhere I go. And I'm a veteran myself, and I was like, man, someday I need to link up with these guys and run with them or train with them or do something. But the mission is I think it's amazing what you're doing.
Thank you.
And
appreciate that.
Thank you for all your hard work and your effort to support the veteran community. And that's got to be kind of a cool feeling to know that your efforts now are, you know, they're global. They're not even just here, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, yeah, the number of lives that we've impacted is, you know, it's pretty significant. The number of people who are married and who are, you know, still alive today because they were in a very dark spot when they found Team Red, White, and Blue, all that. Yeah, it's really humbling to know that the organization's had that kind of an impact on people's lives.
And we kind of glossed over a little bit, but in the runs, right? So in your book, you talk about one of the things that you were doing to kind of like, all right, I've got to, you know, find some ways to de-stress and just kind of have some moments to myself. You started going on these long runs.
Yeah.
And in these runs, you were finding a lot of this inspiration. And one of the things that I had a very similar experience, and I used to work the night shift. I would get off in the morning and we had this running trail right along the Wabash River. And I would 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, depending on what time I got off, I would go 5 for a 5, 7, some days, 10 mile run. I would have all these great ideas. Like my mind would just kind of go blank, but then things would just kind of start popping in. It's just like, wow, you know, I should, you know, if I was been reading a book, things like I've read in the book would just kind of start connecting with other things. So, it wasn't until years later, and maybe you have read this book, but I wanted to show you this. Because this is the second time I've talked about this book on the podcast, but have you ever read John Rattay's work?
Oh yeah. 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 He actually spoke in Chicago in 2013 at our Team Red, White, and Blue's big event. Yeah. He's phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
So you're very familiar then with brain derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, yep. This base chemical BDNF. That's produced in the stomach and it goes to the brain. And if for listeners, if you've never read this book, it's probably in my top 10 books of that I have people read. And then they have a follow-up book called Go Wild. And so, yep. You know, really, I think there's a lot of synergy there with what you're doing with Team Red, White, and Blue in terms of, you know, bringing education and resources to communities that could really benefit from this. And I think the law enforcement community can learn a lot from the work that you've done. And exercise is just not about getting in shape.
Yeah. Totally. So much, so much bigger than that. And that's one of the things that we know, you know, Team Red, White, and Blue is right. It's the physical, the benefits, right, to your heart, to your blood pressure, cholesterol, all those kinds of things. But it's also the benefit to your mental health, your mood, right, which then has a direct impact on the caliber of your relationships and how they go, right? Because if you're in a good mood, you're more likely to see the positive in things. I mean, I say it all the time, but like I'll go on to the Jacob's Ladder or the rower or go run. Things won't make a lot of sense when I start the workout. And when it's over, I gain clarity. I gain a sense of perspective that I just did not have otherwise. So it's not just the physical benefits, it's the mental, right? And you know, John Rattay talks about this. If you could capture all the benefits, physical, mental, emotional, et cetera, of exercise and bottle it up in a pill, you'd be a trillionaire, because it's literally like, it's the most amazing thing, right? But it stinks. Like, no, very few people like the feeling of going there and like being out of breath or, you know, moving your body a whole lot when you can be on the couch, right? Or watching, you know, Netflix or, you know, watching, you know, 8 hours of football on the weekend. There's all kinds of other temptations, you know, which really goes into like my latest read, which is phenomenal, you know, Pat, which I'm sure you've heard of, The Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter, but you know, it is such a powerful read. There you go. Beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable, right? That's such a fantastic, relevant book that, hey, we as humans, we're hardwired, we're programmed, we're DNA, like to seek out comfort. So just know that and understand it. Don't beat yourself up or, throw a guilt trip on yourself, but understand that temptation to move towards comfort is always there and we've got to fight against it.
Yes. The other one too is Steve Magnus' work. It's called Do Hard Work, and he's had a co-author, and I think I've got that one close by too. But I actually read that one before I read The Comfort Crisis, and I heard Michael Easter on the Peter Attia podcast, and I immediately went and bought the book. So you have some amazing stories in this book, the subtitle Inspiring Leadership Through Solitude. And as I'm going through the chapters in your book, and the, you know, you've got examples from Martin Luther King Jr. and from Eisenhower and from Churchill and Jane Goodall, and, you know, which I thought, you know, that of all the stories in the book, that one, I think to me was, I mean, they're all, I guess maybe because I've heard a lot of military stories before, yep, but that one I thought was just completely fascinating. You want to talk about guts.
Yeah. Totally.
So that's a long way of me saying, you know, what was the path for you? And did it all start with this run and kind of this idea, or
how? Yeah. It actually started out with reading an article that was converted from a speech that was given to the plebe class, the freshman class at West Point. And it was given by a professor, a philosophy and history teacher from, I think, Yale at the university at the time. And so it started there, and I actually reached out to him and said, hey, this article, you know, that is converted from your talk is fascinating. I think you should write a whole book on it, you know? And he got back to me and said, hey, appreciate it. You know, I'm really not like a leadership expert. I'm already working on another book. So if you want to read that book, I suggest you research it and write it yourself. And that was the beginning of like, huh, is that even possible? Like, I don't know. And so I began the reflection and discovery process that it is like, hey, this is a really interesting topic. And of course, a lot of work had to be done in there. And that's when I met, you know, my teammate, Ray Kethledge, who's a federal judge in Michigan. And, you know, I met him through my brother-in-law who was clerking for him. And we both like talked a lot about the power of solitude, him a big introvert, me a big extrovert, but we both found power in solitude in our own lives as leaders. And, you know, we embarked on what would turn into a 6-year journey to research and to read about leaders who benefited from solitude and talking to contemporary leaders who tapped into the power of solitude and stitch it all together into this narrative that's now the book that I'm obviously biased, but I tell people, like, if you read that book from cover to cover and you're not inspired to both be a better leader and to tap into the power of solitude, then I've got nothing for you, right? Because, you know, it is pretty compelling, pretty emotional when you think of the stories and the depths of Pope John Paul II and, you know, T.E. Lawrence and, like you said, Churchill and Grant and like some of these MLK, these iconic leaders, and how solitude was a formative part of their leadership practice. And it just was never really examined before until we did that in this book.
Yes. So everybody, you need to go out and get on your Amazon, head to Barnes and Noble, wherever you're going to go, and get a copy of it. Because I mentioned the Jane Goodall one, which I thought was pretty fascinating. Because you mentioned something earlier, right? Like, you have to have experience in something to really understand it. And what for a quick, I'll try to give a quick summary of it. But Jane Goodall, she was kind of, you know, almost what happened to her almost happened by, you know, circumstance or accident. It wasn't even intentional. She winds up being what was her role? She was not even the researcher. She was just an assistant that goes out, and they're trying to study these primates in their natural environment, but these primates are very protective. They're very secure. They're just not going to let anything wander in. It's a threat. But the short version is over time, she starts, you know, in even as a woman, right? She's going and doing things at that time that women just didn't do. And she's wandering off by herself. And she was actually breaking some of the rules there by being by herself. And she just sits and listens and watches. And maybe for me, I'm not a hunter by practice through my whole life. One of my brothers is a big hunter, always wanted me to hunt. But as a chief, I took this opportunity to learn how to shoot a bow. And I told myself, okay, I'm going to go be a bow hunter. And then I have a friend that's got a farm. So I would go, it's got, the Wildcat Creek runs right through this farm. It's 140 some acres. So there's nobody around. And this process of me walking out, climbing up into this tree stand and sitting there, without any distraction and just watching it, it's amazing. Beautiful. The things that you see and that you feel. And now, you know, anyway, that's why that story resonated with me, because every day you go out and you just sit and it's like, well, maybe I could shoot that deer, or maybe I won't, maybe I'll just sit up here for a couple more hours. But for her, it, you know, that was the key, was just to be there alone and in silence long enough to be able to begin to understand what was normal and what was not normal, what the behavior was supposed to be and what it, and getting, you know, earning, quite frankly, the opportunity to be able to see how the primates were actually living in their own environment, and then intuition. Actually bringing her in. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The intuition, right? That was a big part of it. You know, it was just that, that she was able to develop, you know, through that solitude and when spiking 105 degree temperature and all that, like, yeah, I mean, we developed a sense of intuition. We always just kind of call it, oh, I'm just going to listen to my gut. But often our intuition is actually shaped by, you know, time in solitude and reflection.
Yeah. And that was another book that was written by a Michigan grad. It's called Don't Just Blink, Think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever read that book or not.
I've heard of it. I've never read it, but
Malcolm, I know of it. Yeah, that's maybe a story for another day. But Malcolm Gladwell, he wrote a chapter about the Abdu Diala shooting in New York City. And it was kind of just about intuition and the way people react. It's an interesting thought. But for today's purposes in this discussion, do you have one of those stories that was maybe that resonates the most with you or that was the most powerful?
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously it's kind of like, you know, picking your favorite child kind of thing when you, you do all the reading and the thought process. I mean, you know, so me as a lifelong Catholic, like the profile of Pope John Paul II as someone who tapped into the power of solitude, especially through skiing and going out into the mountains, you know, I mean, he probably gets some credit, but deserves a lot more, really, for the fall of communism. I mean, obviously Reagan and Gorbachev were the political leaders, but really the Catholic Church, you know, in, you know, that part of, you know, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, you know, into the USSR area, played an essential role in the fall of communism, in the break of the USSR. You know, certainly powerful. And as a military person, you know, the Ulysses S. Grant story in the Battle of Vicksburg, you know, resonates in a big way. It's, hey, he's, you know, everyone's tried all these different ideas and they haven't worked. And yet people still want to keep thinking inside the box. And Grant, you know, goes into his tent and smokes his cigar and probably has a little bit of whiskey and, you know, spends like all through the night and comes up with a completely outside the box, crazy idea. And of course, everyone's like, no way, that just can't work. That'd be crazy. And he's like, well, you know, are we going to keep doing what everyone else has been doing and failing? And so if you, I don't want to ruin the story, but you know, they cross the Mississippi River, you know, at night, and then they live off the land and they march way south and they envelop and they do these amazing things to finally take Vicksburg, you know? And so that story from a military standpoint, but also just, the power of nonconformity and saying like, well, why are we trying to look at this 5% differently? Well, for this to succeed, it needs to be 50% or 75% different. And that from an inspiration standpoint resonates with me in a big way. So those are probably the two most, powerful stories that resonate with me the most, but all of them have got their own special sauce.
And I'm glad you brought that one up because I have several notes that are written. I write in the tabs and I write in the lines, but in that case, if we bring this back to policing and you think about policing and all the problems that we've been having, you know, quite, it's not new really. If you want to think of, you know, Ferguson and the post Ferguson days, and then moving into, you know, what happened in Minneapolis and just the civil unrest that unfolded because of that. We in the policing world tend to be in the box thinkers. Mm-hmm. And I almost hate
most
to say
people are. Right. Yeah. That's most human beings, you know?
Right. And, you know, it's, I know that gets used a lot, think outside the box, you know,
right.
But what does that really mean? But really, the Grant example is perfect because in policing, what we tend to do is we have an idea or in a concept that something that worked well somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so what do? We copy that and we paste it. And then we try to make it our own.
Yep.
But in that process, we always, you know, I'm not going to say always, but we oftentimes miss the why. The DARE program is a perfect example of this. I'm going to hustle through this. But the DARE program was incredibly successful where it originated in the California area. But later, when they did the evidence-based research on it, they found that no significant difference.
Yeah.
So it's not reducing and matter of fact, in some cases it shows that, well, it might actually be counterproductive. But so is that to say the DARE program is ineffective and doesn't work? No. What it's saying is that the further you get away from the core of what, you know, how DARE began, the greater the differences that you're going to have in your results. And mainly because you can't take the passion and the intent of the people that develop something and transfer that. It's got to, you know, that's got to be the innate, the earned, the part of the program that people want to bring with them. So it's in these things, the training that we go through, the staff and commands and all of those are they're invaluable. You really have to do them, but then you really also have to have time to digest and think about, well, how does this apply to me? How does it apply to my police department? What can we take from this and use, and what maybe, you know, what are some things in here that we shouldn't use? I don't want to give away some of these stories either,
yeah.
But that to me, I think for law enforcement leaders, you can really take a lot from your book and your research and move your agencies forward.
Yeah. And that's just a big part of it, right? Is that I say this very often, but we frequently have the answers to the problems that we face inside our minds and inside our souls, right? And we have to be willing to take the time to chisel them free. And one of the ways that we chisel them free is through solitude, reflection, and meaningful analysis and thinking. That's Ray's and I, one of the big messages of the book, is that part of leadership means you're responsible to do deep thinking. And deep thinking is hard. It's uncomfortable. It's challenging. It takes time. And so we would argue and suggest that leaders have that responsibility, and that if you tap into solitude in that way, you can come up with wildly successful, effective, you know, strategies, game plans, organizations, decisions, right? That you're not going to come up just like on a whim, right? It takes a lot of reflection to be able to get there, you know, and that's where we approach this from. And so I agree with you 100%.
in the stories from the book, I think the undercurrent and the theme that weaves it all together is, and again, I'll just make the analogy for law enforcement leaders, is that sometimes you feel the pressure that there's nobody else that can share that pressure with you, that because you are the ultimate, when you're a captain, when you're a lieutenant, when you're a sergeant, you can make decisions, and we need them to make decisions, but there's really only one person that's ultimately going to be accountable and responsible for those decisions when they are made. And if something is, particularly when things are going wrong, it's easy to be a leader, right? When things are going well, but when they're not going well, it can be a very, very lonely feeling. And sometimes I think we can convince ourselves that nobody has experienced this before and I'm by myself. But then you read about John Paul II and his life and, you know, what his family life was like, you know, losing so many family members at such a young age.
Crazy.
And, you know, then having, you know, Nazis come in and take over. And then the Soviet Union comes back and just replaces tyranny with a different form of tyranny. And, totally. Yeah. So I don't know if you've ever read any of Stephen Kotler's work, but he runs the Flow Research Collective, and so I had this thought when I was reading your book and the stories about John Paul when he was off in the mountains skiing, and that's where he would have some of his greatest thoughts. And it's like, wow, fuck. You know, it's the flow challenge, you know, or the skills challenge equation, you know. Flow follows focus. And so if you put yourself in these, if you give yourself the chance to have these moments of solitude, you can begin to understand the benefit that comes from it, the deep thinking that you get to do, the solutions that come, but you have to give yourself that chance. And I think, and again, sometimes leaders feel like they have to show everybody how busy they are to show what their value is.
Meetings on my schedule and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. For those that haven't gotten this book, maybe can you give me just this quick sneak preview to your most recent book, because I have not read it yet and it's on my list. It's
getting So it's called Leadership is Relationship. And it really builds on this idea of leadership in the information age that we live in is different and more challenging than ever before, in my view, because a lot more people have information, and it may not always be accurate information, but they've got information and they're distracted. And so while in Lead Yourself First, we talk about how the information age and all the distractions and the noise has made it harder to focus, analyze, think, make decisions, and reflect, Leadership is a Relationship says at the same time, in the information age, all the noise and all the distractions makes it harder to be focused on the person right in front of you and harder to connect with people in a relationship-based way, because the world has become more transactional, right? And it's more about, I got to get this done, boop, on to the next thing. And it's really about knocking down targets and tasks. And so really at the core, leadership is about inspiration. It's about getting the best out of people. It's about looking out for people. It's about the human skills. It's about humanity. And in this information age where the pace of life is faster than ever and there's more distractions and noise than ever, it's harder to slow down and to focus on people, right, that you lead and even in the broader context of the ecosystem. So while a very different message, a very similar theme, that the information age, for all of its benefits, for all the great things that it's brought forward to us, it has made it a lot harder to connect with other human beings for lots of reasons. And that at the center of leadership, at the core, is human connection and inspiration with other people.
Well, I don't even want to try to top that.
So it's very timely. It's a very timely read coming out of COVID when, you know, like a lot of people are struggling on the relationship front, and there's more and more technology and AI solutions that allows you to connect with people via text or via Zoom, right? And the power of that in-person face-to-face where the real relationship building stuff happens, it's definitely harder for a lot of people to get back into that face-to-face and into like the really investing in people approach to leadership, because it got very transactional for a period of time, right? Where it was like, hey, we just got to get through this and get as much stuff as we possibly can, keep our heads above water and just keep going. Well, now it's getting back to that relationship aspect. And a lot of people either have already kind of moved on or don't want to go back to the way that it was. And I think a lot of people really struggle to still believe and remember how important relationships are, you know, to leadership and life.
And I don't think it's going to get any better. I think it's really just a matter of us. The technology is here to stay. It's only going to accelerate exponentially. Heck, I was just playing around with ChatGPT the other night.
Yeah.
Just, like, man, it's crazy. I was just trying to think about what it's going to do for law enforcement, but it really made me think of that, what you're saying in Johan Hari's book, Stolen Focus. And then Adam Gazzaley, he wrote The Distracted Mind. You know, he's a neurobiologist or neuroscientist. But, you know, when you have kids and you think about the connection, police officers work in that same kind of really just information overloaded environment. And at the, you know, in order to be successful, you got to be able to distill it all down, control yourself, manage yourself, and then you can be helpful to others. So let's wrap it up there. I do want to give you an opportunity. So for people that might be interested in having you come speak or working with your organization, it's the Character and Leadership Center. Is there an easy way to get a hold of you there? Just go to get online.
Yeah. So it's characterleadership.center, or you can find me, you know, on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way, but yeah, there's multiple websites out there. You can, in the world today, in the information age that we just talked about, right? You can find people pretty easily. I'm not a Luddite. I do, you know, I've got social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. So you can find me on those places individually or characterleadership.center.
And then if you want to get involved with Team Red, White, and Blue.
Yeah. And join Team RWB for Red, White, Blue .org. You can go there. You can go to the app store and download our app. Just typing in Team RWB, you join the team. And yeah, certainly, whether you're a veteran or not, 30% of our members are not vets. You know, there are often lots of members from the first responder, the law enforcement community, or they've got, you know, people in their family who have been in the military. But 30% of our members are not veterans like you and I. And so with open arms invitation to join Team Red, White, and Blue.
All right. There you have it, folks. I want to thank Michael Irwin for being here with us today. You've heard about his books. Go seek them out, read it, and study it. And I promise you, you'll be better off for it. So thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us today. And that'll end it for today's podcast. So till next time, 10:42.
Appreciate it.
The Coptimizer podcast is powered by Performance Protocol. Performance Protocol brings professional executive coaching to police officers and administrators at all levels of the organization. Performance Protocol has the blueprint that will operationalize organizational optimization. It is purpose-built for today's public safety employees to help them accomplish goals and live better. What is it? One-on-one video-based coaching with officers and leaders who have been in your shoes and know firsthand what it means to live and work in public safety. The program will connect you with certified coaches who combine their years of success in the world of law enforcement with world-class training from the cabal of Performance Protocol coaches. Get the support, resources, motivation you need to live the life you want. Performance Protocol coaches are relatable, knowledgeable, and confidential. Most importantly, they get results. Why should the keys to unlocking our peak performance be reserved for just the boardroom or the playing field? Unleash your full potential today and get started with Performance Protocol. Remember, performance is the goal. Protocol is the path. Log into www.performance-protocol.com and learn more about how to bring this program to your agency and community.